Hi, this is Ann Rutherford, and you are listening to TV Confidential.
Oh, you've done it. The car had broken down. You can set up this trap.
Well, I guess we would have found some other way. You know what this place reminds me of? Just seeing all these cars. You know, in our neighborhood, we had a bunch of jokers. I mean, we were a real wild bunch of guys. And we figured out a perfect way to put a car out of commission. You take the potato, you stick it in the exhaust pipe. It doesn't cause any damage, but the car won't start. It was a terrible thing to do. And I got a feeling that the reason I became a cop was to make up for all those jokes I played when I was a kid.
Folks, there are any number of ways to introduce our guest this hour, William Link, but I'm going to steal a line from my friend Bob Thompson over at Syracuse University. Bob once said, the word literate is not often used to describe American primetime television, but it comes up over and over again when discussing the work of William Link and his longtime collaborator, the late Richard Levinson. Once described by the New York Times as Mr. Rolls and Mr. Royce of American television, William Link, along with Richard Levinson, created, written, and adapted 16 on-the-air television series, including Murder, She Wrote, Ellery Queen, The Bold Ones, Mannix, McCloud, Tenafly, The Cosby Mysteries, and just one more thing, a little show called Columbo, which not only continues to play every week in just about every country that has television, including once a day in France and twice a day in Monaco. But if you have a DVD player, you can watch Columbo just about any time you want here in the United States. Bill has recently published the Columbo Collection, 12 original short stories featuring our favorite Rumpel detective. All 12 stories are written by William Link himself, and we'll tell you how you can order the Columbo Collection in just a second. But first, Bill Link, welcome to TV Confidential.
Thank you very much, Ed.
You've talked about Columbo for 40 years, and many books and many papers have been written about Columbo, including the great book, The Columbo File, by Mark Dowidziak. But I guess this book, Bill, I guess this book is the first time you yourself have written about Columbo, isn't it?
That's very true, which is sort of strange after all these years. And, you know, Columbo first came around, I believe, in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
We had done two pilots. Both were number one on NBC. The first one was Prescription Murder, which was originally a stage play that did very well, played all across the United States and in Canada. And that did so well, it was number one in the ratings, as I said. And then NBC wanted us to do a second one, that we didn't have time to do the teleplay, but a very good writer, Dean Hargrove, did the teleplay under our auspices. It was our plot called Ransom for a Dead Man with Lee Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the origin of Lieutenant Columbo.
Of course, that's the origin of the NBC Columbo that most of us have come to know and love, but... And you talk a little bit about this in your introduction to the Columbo Collection, Bill. Columbo actually started off on stage about 10 years earlier, didn't he?
Correct. A important Broadway producer by the name of Paul Gregory wanted to produce it. We had a hell of a cast. Joseph Cotten, who was then a popular movie star, played the murdering psychiatrist. And we had his wife as the girlfriend, and we had Agnes Moorehead, wonderful actress, and we had the great character actor Thomas Mitchell, who played Columbo. And it toured the United States, and it did extremely well. And then about 3-4 years after that, we sold it to Universal, the play, and then we came on board to Universal under the lot, and I wound up staying there 25 years. It was the most creative time of my life, I have to say.
And people like Frankie and I, who love the industry, are eternally grateful, because in many respects, Bill, you You and Richard really elevated the medium.
Thank you.
And especially Universal product. along with Roy Huggins and a couple others.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you. Now, when you first wrote Prescription Murder, I mean, you wrote it more or less as a whodunit. Did you realize that the Columbo character was going to be as big as it was, or was that an accident?
Well, first of all, it wasn't a whodunit. It was a will he get away with
That's
it.
That's right.
We showed the murderer planning the murder and carrying it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then in comes stumbling, bumbling Columbo. You know, he doesn't have a card in his hand. And at that point, the murderer has all the aces. So that was, at that time, unique. It's been copied many times later. But not only was the character unique, people had never seen this kind of guy before, as a detective, no less, but the format was different, was new. And that hooked an audience, too.
I mean, yeah, you talk about the format. When Columbo originally premiered on the NBC Mystery Movie in 71, you know, it was a 90-minute show, and the first, 20, 25 minutes, the hero doesn't even show up.
Correct.
And not only that, once the hero shows up, it's basically he and the antagonist talking to each other, for the remaining 75 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, it's two people circling each other. The problem with the network was, even though the two pilots got big ratings, suddenly, they wanted to cure a hit, as we put it. Networks are prone to do that. If you got a hit, don't mess with the format. And they said, no, you got to bring in the cop in earlier, NBC said, and Dick and I said no. The audience will wait to see him. It adds more suspense to the story.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we were right. And the network, when we were big hit again, when we were the series, then the network said, anything you want to do, boys. And having a network in the palm of your hand, wonderful.
How important was it for Peter? I mean, I understand that, and again, this has been told. You've probably told the story yourself many times. Peter Falk was not the original choice to play Columbo, but he lobbied hard to play the character once he found out about it, didn't he?
Well, we were stupid. We first thought of Bing Crosby. Can you believe that? But if you think about it, he had the pipe instead of the cigar. He was funny. We know that from the road pictures he did with Hope. And he was, sort of a mild, lackadaisical guy. And we sent him the script, and he sent us a very nice letter back saying, boys, I really enjoyed the script, but I do, two specials a year, singing, variety shows, on CBS, and I hear television is a real rat race if you do a series, and I'm out of that. And lucky for Dick and me, Crosby didn't sign on to play Columbo because 5 years later, he dropped dead on a Madrid golf course.
Right,
yeah.
And that was a loss. And one day, it's all at Universal. We're sitting around in our office, and we're thinking, who can we cast to play this cop? Mitchell isn't here anymore. Besides, he was too old then. And we don't have Bing. And who's going to play him? The phone suddenly rang one morning when we were in this dilemma. And it was Peter Falk, out of the blue. And we had known Peter in New York. We used to have breakfast with him. We had the same agent at William Morris. And he was really a fun guy. Smart, very New York with that accent, even though he didn't grow up in New York. And he said on the phone that morning, I'll kill to play that cop. Or he said, I'll kill to play that cop. And that's my bad imitation of him. Peter never liked. But, how he got the script, we never knew. We never found out. I should have asked him. And we said, let us think about it, Peter. We hung up, and Dick and I said, you know, this is what we want. I mean, Falk is, you know, he's not a bad-looking man, but he's not handsome. We didn't want handsome. You know, all the other television heroes, the males, they're all handsome. Uh-uh. Don't want that. This is a guy you'd see on the street like anybody else. And also, we want the humor, which Falk has in spades. And what we knew of Peter was he was sort of like Columbo. He sort of stumbled around a little bit. He wasn't big at all on what he wore every day. Sometimes Peter wore, you know, the same thing twice or three times. And Columbo was certainly not a clothes horse. I mean, the series.
That's an
he wore that one green suit and that raincoat. As my partner Levinson used to say, you know, we have the cheapest wardrobe budget outside of Big Bird on Sesame Street on American television, which is true. So the wardrobe department made up some backup coats in case anything happened to that raincoat. And the original raincoat we used was Peter's own from his closet. Because one day years before, he got caught in a rain squall on 57th Street in New York, and he ducked into a clothing store and bought a raincoat so he could go back out into the rain. And that's the coat that we started with for several seasons on the show.
We, Frankie and I had an opportunity to meet Mike Connors a couple weeks ago.
Lovely man. How is he?
Oh, wonderful.
He's doing well. And he was we met him at the Hollywood show over in Burbank. And
right.
It was the first time he'd done anything like that. And he's at his table, and, you know, we couldn't believe our eyes. He's wearing one of those heavy tweed Mannix coats like he wore on the show, and he told us, you know, the organizers said, okay, wear something that people might recognize you in. And I hadn't thought of this, but in some respects, Mannix's coat became as much a part of that show as Columbo's raincoat.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He was known as the man in the flashy sport coat, and what got Dick and me was that the critics call it a violent show. Now, I have looked back at Columbo. A box set came out, or not Columbo, but a Mannix. A box set came out not that long ago. And, I mean, come on. It wasn't a violent show at all. Television has gotten much more violent because it was forced to when cable came in. Cable was violent right off the bat. And Dick and I did not like violence. You can see it on Columbo or, you know, or our other shows. Our movie of the week, The Execution of Private Slovic with Marty Sheen, that was our favorite two-hour movie that made. We made a whole slew of them. And, well, he got shot to death at the end by a firing squad. But you had to do that because that was
that was the story.
True.
Yeah.
But our other shows, we always try to stay away from violence, and you'll notice nobody smokes. In all the other series in those days, heroes smoked, everybody smoked. Not on our show because we knew a lot of kids were watching, and it's a bad habit, a very bad habit to start.
Well, Columbo smoked cigars.
But it was never lit.
Well, the second season, we wanted to get rid of the cigar with Columbo. And Peter said, no, I like the cigar because it's a good prop. And since he was the 8-pound gorilla then, and the thing was a big hit.
Right.
Don't go against the 800-pound gorilla. If that made him feel more comfortable on camera, fine.
Bill, you know, you were just talking about the violence of, or the lack of violence in Mannix, and I also got the DVD set, and I was looking at the same things you were.
I think there's
some commentary, and I'm watching these shows, and one of the things you rightfully bring out, especially in cable, everything is not only violent, but everything is dark. Everything is twisted.
right.
You know, and I said, why can't they just make a mystery that doesn't have to be dark or twisted? And I'm really getting tired of the serial killers. There's always some serial killer. There's always somebody chopping up somebody. There's always some sexual deviance going on.
Yeah,
you know,
look at Dexter.
Well, yeah, and so today when you look back, you know, I bring this up to Ed from time to time. A while back, I was watching a Barnaby Jones episode.
Yeah.
And Edward Mulhare and Stephanie Powers were on a cliff in San Francisco, and I kid you not, they had a 6-minute scene between them, and there was a 2-shot and then an over the shoulder on each of their shots, and this thing went on for 6 minutes of just dialogue, no music, no nothing, just dialogue.
Right.
And I leaned over to whoever I was watching, and I was watching this with, and I said, you would never in 100 years see this ever again on television, where they would let 6 minutes go by of two people just talking, furthering the plot.
No.
Going through the backstory, it would never, ever happen.
You know, and that's kind of plot and good characters, you can hold an audience even now. Things have evolved, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the younger generation wants quick, quick, quick.
Right.
You know, not a large attention span. They don't particularly like to read books either. That, to me, is not too good, especially with writers in Hollywood. When I lecture at the film schools and at the universities out here, I usually, you know, to the wannabe television or movie writers, I tell them, because they always ask me, how do you plot, Mr. Link? How do you construct a story? You know, tell beginning, middle, and end, and tell your story, you know, not only through the plot, but through your characters. And I tell them, look, read mysteries, even though you don't particularly enjoy mysteries. But the best authors, like the Michael Connellys, some of the others now, Mary Higgins Clark, they know how to plot, construct. You can learn from them. But I don't know if they ever go to those books.
We are talking to Emmy, Golden Globe, and Peabody Award winner William Link, co-creator of Columbo and many, many other acclaimed TV series, TV movies, and feature motion pictures. Bill is also the author of the Columbo Collection, a collection of 12 original Columbo short stories in which Columbo matches wits with the likes of arrogant criminal defense attorneys and neurotic young actresses. You can order the Columbo Collection by going to Bill's website, which is www.williamlinktv.com. That's an appropriate website for you, Bill. .tv.
Excellent, I think.
www.williamlinktv. Or if you are on Facebook, go to the Columbo Collection page on Facebook. Bill, I want to go back to Manix.
Yeah, first. I just want to correct one thing. It's williamlink.tv.
Williamlink.tv.
Got it.
You got it from the horse's mouth. want to ask you another question about Manix, but first, going back to something you just said, when you're talking about young writers today, especially young writers in television, this is a topic that Frankie and I have talked about many times on this program. Back when you and Mr. Levinson, were first starting off, writers lived a little. In your case, you read dime store novels, but you read classic literature. You read Sartre and existentialism. You read everything.
Comic books.
It's all true. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, and there is a richness of experience that came across in your stories and in your characters, and it just seems more often than not, just look at the every year around this time when we're facing the new crop of television shows, it seems like almost all of them, you know, you get the idea that the experience of writers today is just basically watching television. But even if watching television, they don't understand what they're watching.
Yeah.
It's just they're copying. Bill, real quickly, it's always hard for me to think of you and your late partner, Richard, one without the other. And
right.
Even though he's been gone for 20 years, just real quickly, what would he think about what's going on today in television?
Well, Dick always wanted to teach after we retired or were retired from the business, which happens these days. And I think he would have been very disappointed, you know, in the young wannabes, writers, you know, or people who supposedly should be reading books. He would be very disappointed. I don't know whether he would have wound up teaching if he had lived. It's so changed now with everything is a hurry up, you know, quick attention span, and that isn't good. You know, you read a book, you relax, but you have to do some work as you read it, putting things together, especially in mysteries. And I really think Dick would have been disappointed.
I can understand that because, you know? There's just times when I'm watching something and I shake my head. What's interesting is when I go into pitch meetings and they'll tell me something's too cerebral. And I said, cerebral? And they said, yes, cerebral doesn't always work. And I always throw out Columbo back at them. I said,
what do they say?
Well, they kind of look at me. They said, well, Columbo was then. I said, Columbo is still on television. What are you talking? You know, no. I can't butt heads with them too much because, you know, they don't like when you go toe to toe with them.
But, well, that was supposedly, you know, the kids now, you know, or the lawyers, whatever, you know, are running the business. They're at the studios and every other place. That was supposedly the television generation. And when I talked to him this couple of years ago, but, you know, when I was still pitching stuff or trying to, they had no background in television.
Right.
Like, they didn't watch anything.
Not only that, you know, they have no sense of the history of their own, not only of their own medium, but in some cases their own studio.
I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. And,
you know, they're making the big bucks. They got their parking stall. A lot of them, you can smell the flop sweat in the room when you come in. They're afraid they're going to lose all this because there's, you know, big turnovers now. And except for network head, you know, the head of networks, that's a pretty good semi-permanent job. But the others, there's fear because there's such a turnover. And it's not nice to see.
What really bothers me a lot is, I mean, we all know that television was born out of the poor bastard stepchild of the movies, and yep. It's never been able to shake that. So even now, when you talk to students at colleges or you know, wannabe writers, all they talk about is film. They never talk about television, and it's almost like you have to twist their arm, like, television. I want to do movies. And to me, some of the best work that is coming out of Hollywood today, for the most part, is coming out of television. It's not coming out of the theaters, you know. So I don't understand. And the on-running joke is they want to do movies, but they make all their money in television.
That's the tale always, even in my generation. That was the tale that wagged the dog, because it was solid. That money always came in, and you know, movies. That's a gamble. You know, still is.
Right.
But, you know, the thing I've been reading recently, I saw this picture, you know, Inception, which is the real hot movie.
Mm-hmm.
Dreams within dreams within dreams. I don't know whether you guys have seen it yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, I saw it.
And to me, it was just puzzles within puzzles within puzzles. But I'm an old guy. And the young people are really making that thing a hit. They like to figure out the puzzles because they play video games. That's what it goes back to.
So you would think
if they like puzzles in video games, why wouldn't they like them like in mystery books? It's not converted in their minds, one thing to another. I just don't understand it. But as I said, you know, I'm up there in years.
Bill, are there any shows or networks on television that you watch today?
I rarely watch series. To me, you know, I know all the plots, and there's only so many plots under the sun. And they're variations, you know. Everything is a variation, even in my days, in television. There's really nothing new except maybe in characters. I mean, Monk, You can see really the antecedents was in Columbo.
Right.
And I don't watch series. I watch politics. I'll watch Turner Classic Movies. They've got a lot of the good old movies on, and you see how they were made in those days. Wow. And I'm just not a television fan anymore.
We are talking to Emmy, Golden Globe, Peabody, and Edgar Award-winning mystery writer William Link, co-creator of Columbo, Mannix, Murder, She Wrote, Ellery Queen, and many other acclaimed TV series and made-for-TV movies. We will continue our conversation with Bill right after this.
They say that life never gives us more than we can handle, that whatever doesn't break us only makes us stronger. We've heard it said a thousand times, and yet it really is true. Just ask Brooks and Gene Davis. They spent 12 years helping their son Ron overcome addiction. They had just overcome this tragedy when suddenly they were dealt another. Just as Ron was pulling his life back together, he was brutally murdered, and it would be 8 years before his killer was finally brought to trial. It's enough to make anyone drown in despair, and yet good things do come to those who wait. At least that's what faith tells us. But how many times can one spirit be tested before it is finally broken? That's the challenge that faces Brooks and Gene Davis in Keep On Keeping On, the true story of two ordinary people with extraordinary faith despite the worst of circumstances. Keep On Keeping On, published by Zulon Press. Available at keeponkeepingonbook.com, amazon.com, and wherever books are sold.
Hello, this is Joe Campanella coming to you on TV Confidential.
Ed Robertson and Frankie Montefiore, along with our guest William Link, Emmy Award-winning writer, producer, and co-creator of Columbo, Mannix, Ellery Queen, Murder, She Wrote, and other acclaimed TV series and made-for-TV movies. Bill is also the author of the Columbo Collection. The Columbo Collection, a collection of 12 original short stories featuring Lieutenant Columbo. You can order the Columbo Collection by going to www.williamlink.tv. www.williamlink.tv. For our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, Bill will be one of the featured speakers at BoucherCon by the Bay. BoucherCon by the Bay, which will be held at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in San Francisco on October 14th through October 17th. For more information, go to www.bcon2010.com, www.bcon2010.com, www.bcon2010.com. For our listeners in the Los Angeles area, Bill will be appearing at the 9th Annual West Hollywood Book Fair, 647 North San Vicente Boulevard in West Hollywood on Sunday, September 26th. For more information, go to www.westhollywoodbookfair.org, www.westhollywoodbookfair.org. Finally, for our listeners in the Orange County area of Southern California, Bill will also be appearing at the 11th Annual Men of Mystery Luncheon at the Irvine Marriott Hotel in Irvine, California on Saturday, October 30th. For more information, go to www.williamlink.tv, www.williamlink.tv. We will continue our conversation with Bill Link in just a moment. First, a reminder that the next edition of TV Confidential will premiere the week of September 6th on this station. We'll have something old and something new for you that evening. The something new will be our thoughts on this year's Emmy Awards telecast, which will premiere during the off week of our broadcast. We'll talk about who won, who lost, who should have won, who was funny, who wasn't funny, all that and more. We'll also have an encore presentation of our interview with Michael Seth Starr, author of The Secret Life of Raymond Burr, an excellent biography of the man known to all of us as Perry Mason and Ironside. So if you haven't heard our interview with Michael Seth Starr, we invite you to join us as we replay it on our next program. For our listeners on Showcase Internet Radio, a reminder that the next edition of Stu's show will premiere on Wednesday, August 25th. Joining Stu that night will be Wes Hyatt and Steve Beverly as they discuss the latest news in daytime television. For more information, go to www.showcaseradio.com. Bill, let me ask you this. When you sat down to write the Columbo as a series of short stories,
right,
was it harder for you to do that or easier?
No. I have written short stories forever. Dick and I started writing short stories. Our first short story was purchased by Fred Danet, who was one half of Ellery Queen.
Mm-hmm.
The Ellery Queen novels we all read when Dick and I were kids. And so we first wrote, Fred Danet published our first crime story called Whistling While You Work in Ellery Queen magazine. And I'm still selling stories to Ms. Huggins on for the Ellery Queen magazine. Used to sell to Hitchcock. So this afternoon, I was working on a Columbo short story. And I mostly have done straight crime short stories. All of them are published. So it was easy, very easy for me to sit down and write my most popular character I could write in my sleep, the Columbo collection.
Well, especially because, you know, the essence of Columbo on the show is dialogue.
Yeah.
And right. the essence of the stories in the Columbo collection, I mean, it's very easy to picture this, you know, on as if you're watching it on television, because it's basically the two characters talk to each other.
Yeah, and when I wrote it, I saw Peter Falk,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Columbo. I just couldn't get away from it. Columbo is Peter Falk, even though the original stage play, which is still playing, in fact, it's touring Great Britain now. That's how popular Columbo is in Great Britain. Also in France, also in Italy. The Japanese are huge fans. They were over here 2 years ago for an hour and a half interview with me on film, all about Columbo, still one of the Japanese most favorite characters. It's incredible. Dick always said, of all the television series we've had on the air, it'll be written on my tombstone, co-created Columbo. And he was right.
There are worse epitaph, Bill. We had Everett Chambers on our program about a year ago.
Oh, sure.
And Everett told us that at one point, because in the second year, I think you guys did a show in the UK. And then Everett said that there was talk about doing a Columbo that would be filmed in Japan, but for whatever reason, it didn't get off the ground. Can you elaborate on that?
There's not much to elaborate on. It all stemmed, I think, from the fact that Lou Wasserman, who was the genius head of MCA Universal in those days, and was a friend of Dick's and mine,
mm-hmm.
he always wanted us to make a Columbo feature motion picture. And Peter was not up for that. I think Peter considered himself a motion picture star, big screen personality, actor, and that Columbo was sort of a launching pad for that. And Peter has done, you know, a lot of good low-budget pictures because he's a wonderful actor, even though, you know, when he's not playing Columbo, things he did with his best friend, John Cassavetes, mm-hmm. back then. But it was always, Peter didn't want to make a Columbo feature film. And that was it.
Well, there's always reasons for why people want to do something, not do something. I think a lot of TV shows that have gone to the big screen, most of them have been missteps. And
well, there's talk now about a big screen movie of Murder, She Wrote, and supposedly they got a good star from it, but that's all I know.
Yeah, she'll probably be 35 years old.
Well, yeah, and you know, and Angela will do a cameo in it.
Right. Let me ask you this: when you were doing the new Columbo book, I know you've been, as I said before, you know, Richard's been gone quite a while now.
Yeah.
And you're still working. When he first passed, did you have to rework your style? Meaning that because I guess you guys were so working, you two were so close to the collaboration process that you had to find yourself, okay, now I got to do this, but now I got to I got to do this just a little bit differently. Do you find it easier? Is it harder? Or is it just different?
Well, Stephen Bochco, who's a great guy and a terrific writer, has been a longtime friend. And he's said in interviews, the first time he met Dick and Bill, he said, I had never met two guys like that. They literally thought with the same brain. And that was true. We not only finished sentences together, we started sentences together. So when Dick died, it was a terrible shock. And I had some psychiatric help. And then I thought, well, I got to see if I can write without Dick. Now, in my favor was, Dick was very good with character, as I was. He was very good with plotting, as I am. You know, we had all the same attributes, very strong. That's why we were a powerhouse, you know, in television. And I sat down, and the first thing I wrote after Dick's death was an original screenplay for the big screen. It's called Hit, and it sold to Universal. Two studios wanted it, 20th Century Fox and Universal, and I sold it to Universal. So then I figured, you know, I could write without Dick, and it was never a problem. I find writing, unlike a lot of other writers, very easy. I can't wait to get to the computer to write. I don't feel right every day unless I've done some writing. But I've been doing that. Yeah, I've been writing since I was 8 years old.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Bill, Stephen King told me many years ago, he said, it doesn't get done unless you sit down and plant your butt in the chair and do it. And you can't worry about whether it's good or whether it's bad. You just have to get it out in your system, because you can always go back and take the stuff that's, you know, garbage. Yeah. and fine tune. He said that's why it's called drafting. And what I loved about that comment is what he said was the same thing all my teachers used to say in high school and grammar school. And it's just, yeah, it doesn't get done unless you sit down and do it.
Correct. But, you know, many, many writers are scared in the old days of facing a blank white page, or now getting up and going to the computer. I have a friend in New York City, a very fine writer, and he literally gets up in the morning. He is so fearful, he throws up in the toilet. And I said, I wouldn't write, you know. If it affected me, you know, that strongly and so harshly and so negatively. But he makes a lot of money every year, and he puts up with it.
My only comment for that, Bill, is everybody has their process. We are talking to William Link, co-creator of Columbo and more than 16 acclaimed television series, made-for-TV movies, and feature motion pictures. Bill is also the author of the Columbo Collection, a collection of 12 original short stories that you can order by going to www.williamlink.tv, www.williamlink.tv. TV. Let's see. Want to go back to Mannix for just a second. You mentioned Lou Wasserman, and I understand when, and I don't know whether it was whether the I guess the idea would have been pitched to Wasserman, would have been pitched to Desi.
No. It was a Paramount show.
Right.
And it started at Desi Lou.
Right.
So Wasserman had nothing to do with it at Universal. We sold Mannix on one line to a guy who was buying for Desi Lou, Paramount. And the one line was, I'll probably have to translate it a little bit for your listeners. The line was, Humphrey Bogart at MCA Universal. And here's the translation. Wasserman and Universal, they were into electronics way before any other studio. Wasserman was such a futurist and a far-looking individual. And Humphrey Bogart, we saw as, you know, sort of a rumpled guy. He had played in Maltese Falcon, you know. And he was into people. He knew motivations. He knew what made people tick. Whereas his boss, and we call him on Mannix, Lou Wickersham, that was a big industry joke at the time because it was really Lou Wasserman. You know, in those days at MCA Universal, all his ex-agents who were then producers and everything at the studio, they all wore dark suits, sometimes, you know, dead black suits, white shirts, and nondescript ties, gray ties or black ties. And that was our concept that was very well understood by the guy we were pitching to at Desilu Paramount, and that became Mannix.
Bill, let me ask you this. Okay, the Lou Wickersham character on Mannix, played by Joe Campanella, he was the button down, he was the suit, and right. Mannix was the lone wolf, you know, who was always kind of
right.
You know, bucking the system. Okay, which one of you and Richard, which one of you was more like Mannix, and which one of you was more like Wickersham?
Neither one of us. No, these are created out of, you know, thin air, blue air. I was probably better dressed than Dick. He was not a big clothing guy. He wore the same pair of shoes forever. They were down at the heel, and Dick didn't care, and he didn't have to. And but in those days, every day we wore sport coats, slacks, shirts, and ties. And that all went away as the years went on. It's very casual now. You would never go into a meeting dressed like that. There was a method to our madness in those days, because writers, even back then, you know, were casual. And we dressed like the enemy, the people we were pitching to, the people at the networks. When we came in, we looked like them as far as attire went. That was psychological. They weren't dealing with a rumpled writer wearing, you know, jeans and a T-shirt like some writers wore. We were dressed like them. So we wanted, in a way, a small way, to put those people who are trying to sell to at their ease.
That's a good strategy.
Well, we were clever devils.
I find it amazing today. You know, you talk about just the way you wrote and having a respect for, you know, what you do. Obviously, that when I go into a pitch meeting, I'm always dressed, and the people that I'm pitching to are in jeans,
yep.
Rumpled shirts.
Yep.
They haven't shaved. Their hair looks like they just woke up and just rolled out of bed. And I'm always amazed that here they are. They're making the kind of money they're making.
Yeah.
And they're running this network, or the head of production, or the head of development, and they look like this. And I'm just, you know, and it to me, it's telling when I'm the best dressed person in the room.
Yeah.
I'm like,
no,
okay,
don't worry about it.
Right.
You know, what they've done out here in Hollywood now is every day is casual Friday.
Right.
You know, 5 working days a week. That's the way they dress. Loose, you know, comfortable, no neckties. And that's how it's evolved.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I want to just shift gears really quickly. You and Richard wrote a book called Stay Tuned.
Yes.
Which I picked up. It was one of the first film books or books about the industry.
Yeah, right here in my library, in my study where I'm sitting.
I love this book. I picked it up. I think I was about 12 or 13 at the time. I've read it probably about 25, 30 times.
Wow.
And it's such a great nuts and bolts of the history,
yes.
Not only of television.
Kramer, for the way television works,
right,
and what you're going to face, confront, and we were very proud of that book because a lot of our knowledge, most of it, went into it about, you know, what happens behind the camera, how you have to deal, and at the time, it was taught in many universities and film schools. I doubt it now because it was published a long time ago. You know, And many more things have happened since then, of course.
Yeah, but the fact that we mentioned it on programs such as ours, it'll drive people back to the, you know, to the library and the Amazon to take a look at it and add it to their collection if they do not already have it.
And well, that would be nice if they did it, and I hope, you know, some things are still helpful in it.
Well, I'll tell you, to our listeners, let me just say this is one of the best books on the history of the medium of television you will ever read. Essentially, they just break down what it was like working in television at the factory, because you and Richard were obviously a notch or two above, you know, what was going on there at the time, with some exceptions. And they brought a lot of class and dignity to Universal. And they would talk about when you talked about My Sweet Charlie or the execution of Private Slovak. I mean, some of these amazed that certain summer and what it took to get on and how you had to deal with censors. And it really is just it's so telling. About what was going on at the time, and it to me it's a great trip down memory lane of what was, and you know, probably in some respects still is.
Well, I thank you. I just don't think, you know, as the college professors tell me, this is amazing, that the first day of class, you know, if it's they have a reading list, kids tell them, you know, we're not going to read anything, we don't want to read. And we know that here's a certain percentage, you know, of people who have to graduate class, and we'll gamble.
I you know, it's
incredible.
It's amazing.
If it's not on a screen, it has like no validity.
We're all just sitting here trying to figure that one out.
There's a lot of bright kids out there, you know. I'm not going to put down.
Yeah.
A lot of smart kids.
Let me ask you this, Bill. Frankie mentioned My Sweet Charlie that certain summer. And obviously, you know, and you do talk a little bit about, you know, some of the problems you had to overcome to get those projects made.
Yep.
But one of the things that we admire about you and Richard is that, and again, this goes back to one of the things we said at the top of the program. You know, you always saw television in the best possible light, and you were not afraid to, you know, introduce subject matter that we all knew was going on if you read the paper, but we didn't see
right
on television.
Right. We prided ourselves on that. You see, Dick and I had grown up on the original dramas in the early years of television. I had a television set, don't believe this, in 1946. Mm-hmm. My family had it. Because my father was a gadget freak, and we were the most popular, you know, family in the community, in the township, back in the suburb of Philadelphia, because we had this amazing box with all these things on it. And the first television series, people don't know this, was called Barney Blake Police Reporter, Mystery Crime Show. The first television series ever on American television. And we had seen on Philco Playhouse in those days, the U.S. Steel Hour, they did all original hour dramas. And Dick and I loved them. We grew up on them when we were in early teenagers. And you had wonderful writers writing for them. Gore Vidal.
Patty Chayefsky.
Oh, the wonderful Patty Chayefsky. Yeah.
Reginald Rose.
Oh, another very good one. And he did the great jury show. And that really
right.
got us interested in television. We were big movie buffs anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We were big fans of motion picture music. During the Golden Age, we had these amazing composers like Miklos Rozsa and Max Steiner and Dmitri Tiomkin and Franz Waxman. And people, the composers in those days who wrote melody. Now, melody is linear again, just like writing, you know, a television show. It's linear. And that, I don't know, scripts are so garbled now. You go to see feature films, and the stories are so blah.
Well,
and, you know, they don't build to a good climax. And you only get that, you know, from reading books.
Well, also the problem there is they have, you know, they have teams of writers. Two writers sell a script, and they don't let them do the rewrites, so they bring in another team
exactly.
of writers.
And but then... you see, in the golden age of movies, the late 30s into the 40s, they had various people working on one screenplay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Look at Casablanca.
Five writers.
I mean, you had Howard Koch worked on it, then those great twins, the Epstein brothers came in, and then people did some noodling on the writing after that. There were, you know, various writers on pictures back then, but boy, some of those pictures were good.
Well, you know, sometimes it was just, you know, really good luck that you could bring wonderful writers in. Now it's just about... you know, your agent wheeling a deal, and some of these people shouldn't even be allowed to write, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And it's why I'm really not crazy about film as much as I was. But I will say this, one of my favorite films growing up that I've seen, I kid you not, I've seen this film probably about 20 times, is Roller Coaster.
They used to play that in a big video store here. Because they loved it so much, and the patrons loved it.
I love the film. I can quote dialogue from it. It's just, George Segal. When I ran into Quentin Tarantino, we had a conversation about Roller Coaster for about a half hour.
You're kidding?
No, I am not kidding. And we dissected this movie scene by scene by scene, and I still love it. I love it's such an LA movie. That, you know, I mean, this was the L.A. I grew up in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I remember I saw it in Sensaround.
Yeah.
At the Bruin Theater in Westwood.
Rumbled.
Yeah. And it was great. And they run it on cable all the time. And it's just, I still watch it every time.
He wrote that script in about 3 weeks.
It's great.
We were so hot on it. Jennings Lang, who was a terrific producer at Universal, he was in the famous Black Tower, and we loved Jennings Lang, and he wanted us to write a summer movie, and that's what we did. And we had such fun writing it, and then we always liked George Segal, and he starred in it. We liked that, too.
The cast is great.
I have not seen that movie on DVD as much as you have.
Yeah, it still holds up beautifully. It still holds up, and it's a great summer movie.
That I think worked back then, and I still work today. And I'm very flattered that Tarantino liked that picture.
Yeah, we talked about it for about a half hour.
That.
Bill, a few years prior to that, you did a show for NBC for one of the NBC mystery movie shows with James McEachin called Tenafly.
Yeah,
and that was a show that broke ground in a lot of ways, didn't it?
Yep, because the Cosby Show, and I worked for Bill, you know, years later, actually a couple of years ago, he did the comedy, which is the big breakthrough, but no one had done, you know, a serious drama, you know, with some humor, but mostly, you know, a dramatic series. We were the first there, because you saw his family, you saw his wife. You know, he was the token black at a white Beverly Hills, you know, all-white detective agency. And Dick and I really liked the show. It was NBC. We couldn't get a rating.
Which is too bad because, you know, McEachin is such a good actor. He's one of those money in the bank actors that no matter what you ask him to do, he does it, and he does it very well.
Yeah, it's true. And... a shame, but you know, with a black detective in those days, you could not. I think that's all changed now.
Yeah, about a few years ago, he did a show, McEachin. He did a show with Jim Garner called First Monday, and Charles Floyd Johnson invited me onto the set, and
he's still a friend and his wife,
and he's a good guy. But Charles introduced me to James McEachin, and the first thing I said was Tenafly, and his. And his face lit up. He said, "Man, nobody's talked to me asked me about that show in 30 years."
Incredible. Yeah, I believe it. Yeah. Nobody saw it.
Well, it's a good show, folks. And if you look hard enough, you can find it somewhere.
Yeah, it's somewhere.
Bill, it's hard to believe we only got a few minutes left. I would like to ask you at least one question about another one of my favorite shows.
Sure. Sure.
And that's the Ellery Queen show that you and Richard did in 1975. And
they just shot me. That's coming out in a small box set because we didn't do a lot of those. And they interviewed me and filmed me talking about what I remember about the show. Ellery Queen, way back when Dick and I were kids, there was actually two guys, two cousins, Fred Dene and his cousin, as I said before. They were very popular. They wrote a series of books. Ellery Queen was a young man whose father was the inspector of police in New York City, and he really solved the stuff. And we loved that series when we were kids of books, so Dick and I wanted to do it as a series, and we did, and we found out a couple years later when I met Fred Dene for the first time, and we spent a whole afternoon at him and his house talking mysteries, which was fabulous, that was his favorite show that had ever been done of his character Ellery Queen. And there were various other Queen things gone way back. And so that made us very proud.
You know, look, I don't know the character as well as you and Richard did. And I haven't seen any of the other TV adaptations of Queen. I can only judge the Jim Hutton show on its own merits. But
right.
I liked the Jim Hutton show as a kid. I've had an opportunity to watch it again in recent months. I like it as much, you know, today as I did then. I think it's
good
still
show.
It holds up, and I
holds up very well.
I think, I mean, I know a lot of people have knocked Hutton for the way he played the character, but I like the way he played it, and I love the rapport between he and David Wayne.
Yeah, it was wonderful, and Jim Hutton was so dedicated to playing that role. He never left the studio. He lived at the studio, if you can believe that. No star does that. He did. He could get up early, he could work on the script again, and it was all ready to shoot that morning when, you know, the rest of the cast and the crew came in.
I love that.
He was terrific.
Well, he was terrific, and you have been terrific, William Link.
You
know, please join us again one of these nights on TV Confidential.
Let me know.
William Link?
Be happy.
Oh, and we will be happy to have you back.
Pretty well informed, I'll tell you that.
Thank you.
We like hearing that. William Link is the author of the Columbo Collection. The Columbo Collection, a collection of 12 original Columbo short stories in which Columbo matches wits with arrogant young criminal defense attorneys and neurotic young actresses. You can order the Columbo Collection by William Link by going to www.williamlink.tv, www.williamlink.tv. Folks, we'll be right back.
If you haven't been listening to TV Confidential, this is who you're missing.
Jack Klugman.
Lee Merriweather.
William Shaller.
Lee Majors.
Dan Frischman.
Sally Kellerman.
Linda Casey.
Kathy Garver. Kim Bobby.
Richard Anderson.
Susan Olson.
Tom Dreesen.
And many, many more of your favorite celebrities and people behind the scenes in the world of television. That's TV Confidential. Every week on this station and every day online at tvconfidential.net.
One more item. And as a matter of fact, folks, this is something you'll probably hear a lot over the next few weeks. So please bear with me. We are taking a survey of our listeners, and we would really like you to participate. It will help us learn more about you, our audience, no matter how long you've been a listener to TV Confidential or how often you listen to our show. So when you have a moment, please visit our website, tvconfidential.net, and click on the listener survey link, which you'll find on both the homepage and the archives page at tvconfidential.net. It will only take a few minutes, and you can complete the survey anonymously. Thank you so much for helping us, and thanks as always for listening to TV Confidential.
Hi, this is Randy Casey speaking, and you listen to TV Confidential with Ed Robertson and Frankie 140.
Ed Robertson with a reminder that Denny Miller will be appearing at the Western Legends Festival in Kanab, Utah on August 26th, 27th, and 28th. For more information on this and other upcoming appearances, go to www.denny-miller.com. www.denny-miller.com. William Link will be appearing at the 9th Annual West Hollywood Book Fair, 647 North San Vicente Boulevard in West Hollywood, California, on Sunday, September 26th, as well as at BoucherCon by the Bay at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in San Francisco on October 14th through 17th, and the 11th Annual Men of Mystery Luncheon at the Irvine Marriott Hotel in Irvine, California on Saturday, October 30th. For more information on these appearances, as well as information on how to order the Columbo Collection, go to www.williamlink.tv, www.williamlink.tv. That will do it for our program tonight, folks. If you have thoughts on what you heard, if you would like to stay apprised of upcoming guests, send us an email at talk@tvconfidential.net, talk@tvconfidential.net. We are also now on Facebook, and you can find our Facebook page by clicking the button at tvconfidential.net. In the meantime, Ed Robertson, on behalf of Frankie Montaforti, thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next time on TV Confidential.